Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, my name is Connor Boyack. People say, well, what's your background? I'm just a web developer. I mean, I've got nothing special, but I started a blog about probably 7 years ago, and it was just like what you might think a blog traditionally as it was today. I went here, or this dinner was great, and it was very much just an individual blog, and I didn't think anyone would read it, and lo and behold, people started reading it, and that kind of made me do a little bit of introspection, say, do I really want to be sharing this kind of silly stuff that I thought just my family was reading? And that kind of encouraged me over a few months in the first year of doing it to start sharing some of my thoughts and opinions. Rather than just being kind of a journal or something silly like that, it was to become more of an intellectual journey and an educational journal almost for me, as I would study things and wanted to share them, wanted to articulate them in written format so I could share them with other people. So that was about 7 years ago, and since that time it's become a lot more structured, a lot more like a newspaper column almost, in really trying to do a lot of research and advocate for things. So that educational journey over the span of many years, I found myself years down the process finding others who were on the same journey, learning about the Constitution, learning about liberty, perhaps just getting started in that endeavor. And I was asked sometimes, well, what do you think about this issue or that issue, or what does the Constitution say about this? And I wanted to provide for those people something that the information that I had found along the way. And I didn't really find a good resource to do that. I had realized then that I had learned, my educational journey was very bits and pieces. It was very fragmented. And I would find an article here, or I would read this part of the Constitution that applied to whatever issue, or this scripture, what have you. But it was very fragmented, and so I decided to write a book. As Russ mentioned, it's called Latter-day Liberties. Many of you already bought it. I've got some copies out there. And the intent of that book was, for me, to provide people with a single tangible resource to say, here, at least is my understanding over these years of what liberty is. What does the Constitution say? What is natural law and freedom? I had found some good resources, but a lot of them were very fragmented as well. By that I mean, for example, Ezra Taft Benson, who many of you, I'm sure, esteem like I do. A lot of his books are simply compilations of addresses that he's given. And every address is just a different topic, and it's very kind of segmented. And I wanted a book that would kind of start with the very basics and build upon that and flow. And so that's what I tried to do in the book. Now, what I wanted to talk about today relates in the fact that the title of my address is The Need for Constitutional Consistency. And that was an interesting thing for me as I started writing the book, was that it wasn't really new information. It was more just a compilation of what I had already learned and what I believed and what I wanted to share with other people. But what I found was, as I started working on the book, I realized that there was a lot of inconsistency, both in myself. I saw over time my own educational journey and how the whole time I revered the Constitution, but along the way, I had been supporting unconstitutional things, and I would have to identify those and correct them and come to embrace the constitutional or the pro-liberty position. And I look around as I'm writing the book, as I'm sharing the book now with people, I think that is the biggest political problem of our day, is inconsistency. By that I mean advocating for an ideal, but then also supporting measures or policies or programs which run contrary to that ideal. So I wanted to start with a quote that I think kind of encapsulates what I'm trying to say, and then I'll get into some of the particulars to demonstrate what I mean. This is by James Madison. I'm sure you've all heard this quote. He's describing kind of the way things were, and I'm sure you'll agree that they're not so much this way anymore. This is James Madison. He says, "The free men of America did not wait till usurped power had strengthened itself by exercise and entangled the question in precedence. They saw all the consequences in the principle, and they avoided the consequences by denying the principle. We revere this lesson too much soon to forget it." So what's James Madison saying? What I think he's saying is that back in the founding generation, they understood the principles of liberty so well that even on perhaps the popular issues, or maybe the benign issues that seemed rather innocuous and not so important, that they were still able to identify the underlying principle in the measure, in the bill being proposed, in whatever issue, and whether that principle was a good or a bad one, support it or if necessary, oppose it. Whereas I think in our day, a lot of that's reversed, that we don't understand, we speaking generally, we don't understand the principles that are underlying some of the policies. Maybe we're being benefited by a certain program, or we know someone whose business would be harmed if a law was passed, and it's a bit more superficial. Do we recognize the principle before it becomes a precedent that can then be built upon to further violate that principle? I think, you know, perhaps with some of what I say, I'll be preaching to the choir, because maybe some of you feel that you do understand those principles and you can readily identify the violations of them and oppose them. And if that's the case, I applaud you. Nonetheless, I think sometimes the choir still needs to be preached to. So I hope you'll forgive me if you feel that this doesn't apply. So I wanted to talk about last Thursday, a week ago from this past Thursday, the Republican caucuses. So I used to be a member of the Constitution Party, and when Ron Paul ran for presidential nomination last time, I followed suit per his campaign's encouragement, decided to join once again the Republican Party. And I attended my caucus with the intent of going to support Ron Paul and candidates for delegate and precinct leadership who were Ron Paul supporting individuals. I'm sure many of you likewise support Ron Paul and recognize his more strategic reasons for staying within the Republican Party. So I decided to do the same. And I attended and ended up becoming the vice chair of my precinct and kind of got stuck in the Republican Party for a while. And decided to pursue the same course that Ron Paul has. And so 2 years ago, I was on Mike Lee's campaign. I was a social media director when he was seeking the nomination. I was still a Republican at that time, and our caucus had an overwhelming turnout. If you remember, that's 2010, right when the Tea Party got started, when Obamacare had just been passed. So whereas 4 years ago, we had 7 people at my Republican caucus, for a fairly large size precinct. 2 years ago, we had 87. So we had a huge turnout numbers. We were totally unprepared for it. And so many of the people who came were very upset about Obamacare. I was the chair by then, because the chair had left to join the Libertarian Party. And so I was conducting the meeting, and I had people raise their hands. Who here is here because of Obamacare? And like two-thirds raised their hands. They were upset. They wanted to do something about it. They recognized that Obamacare was wrong. They recognized the violation of principle. Yet it was interesting, as I got to know some of those people better, that I found that inconsistency. I wasn't yet working on the book, but some of those the ideas were kind of coalescing, and I was beginning the outline and thinking a bit more about it, and recognizing this pattern of inconsistency. These people, rightly so, objected to Obamacare. That's a good thing to do, and it is a violation of principle. Yet I would discuss with them various other issues, and some of these I'll get into a little bit later, and find that they supported things that violated the Constitution. So I wonder, why do you support the Constitution for something that you agree with, but oppose it for something that you don't? And it was just more a thought in the back of my head. So this past week, I was still the chair of the Republican precinct that I was in, and led the meeting, and we had just an even more overwhelming turnout, double what we had 2 years ago. And it was really interesting to see a lot of the arguments that were made. Of course, the dynamics that we had this time were pro-Hatch people. The Hatch campaign spent about $5 million to get their friendly people out to the caucuses. They had a lot of the teachers' union, as always, was very out in support of getting their people to the caucuses. So I had one woman raise her hand as we were getting ready to elect the state delegates. And she asked, or she said, the question for the state delegates that she posed was, if we don't elect Senator Hatch, my child, and I'm very much paraphrasing, but this was the intent of her remarks, is going to suffer and die. She explained that her child had some rare form of type 1 diabetes, and that Senator Hatch was on a weekly basis calling the FDA on her behalf and making sure that any bureaucratic red tape for her daughter to receive some benefit, some program that was being given to these people with this rare form of type 1 diabetes would continue to you know, no red tape, everything should flow, give us our money. And it was very emotional. She was basically equating the fact that electing Senator Hatch equals keeping my daughter alive. And she finished her question, and many people around her kind of gave her a high five and nodded their head and good question. And of course, I'm the chair. I'm having to be fair and you know, proverbially biting my tongue. But I was running to be a state delegate, and I lost to the Hatch folks. And so in my remarks, I upheld the importance of the Constitution. And I sympathized, of course, with her daughter, how tragic that must be. But that at least constitutionally, anything to be done to help her daughter must be done at the state level. And that is not a sufficient reason, in my opinion, to support, nominate, and ultimately elect someone like Senator Hatch. Well, it was really interesting that night. There were many emotional arguments like that. And they overtook the more intellectual arguments. As one example, I brought up the NDAA, which some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, the National Defense Authorization Act. I see some nodding their heads. And for the benefit who don't know, that was signed by President Obama on New Year's Eve. Of course, everyone's not paying attention. And it gives, or rather purports to give, the authority to the President of the United States to indefinitely detain an American citizen without any due process. No jury trial, no habeas corpus, on the mere suspicion of aiding and abetting a terrorist alone, which they've now defined as having food storage and using cash instead of credit cards and using privacy on your browsers so that they can't track, people can't track your internet behavior. They've greatly expanded, of course, the definition of what a terrorist is. But we have the NDAA, which allows the president, one man, to say, we suspect you of being a terrorist or a terrorist sympathizer. Therefore, we're going to lock you up indefinitely until the end of hostilities, which, of course, in the war on terror, there is no end. There's no definition of what is an objective. Therefore, it's indefinite, as the power says. So I made this case, and I explained to my precinct what the NDA was. And I, in a fair way, it wasn't to rail on Hatch, but I, in fact, someone asked the question, which was a great setup, and said, well, who in Utah voted for it? And I was able to list that Matheson did, and Rob Bishop did, and Orrin Hatch did. Of course, many of the people who came out that night were there to support Orrin Hatch. Nevertheless, the emotional arguments took the day. Many people who were there 2 years previous to protest Obamacare, who railed against many of the things that Obama was doing on constitutional grounds, were supporting candidates as delegate who were advocating things that ran afoul of the Constitution. So again, back of my mind, churning this inconsistency of programs I don't like that are unconstitutional, I'm going to oppose. Programs I do like that are unconstitutional, let's not, you know, object to those at all. Let's not pay attention about them. So, you know, being members of the Constitution Party, you'll agree with me that at a minimum, the Constitution should be the litmus test for candidates for office. And I say at a minimum because something is constitutional, that doesn't necessarily mean it's a good idea. It's constitutional for Congress to declare war, but do we want them declaring war against any country for any reason and for non-defensive purposes and we're broke, but let's go do it anyways? No, right? Just because it's constitutional doesn't mean that it's a good idea. But that should be the litmus test. We need to remember, and I want to read here a couple of the oaths of office that are taken, because I think this is really important to help us in determining who we're going to support as candidates for nominations and ultimately for elections. What is the basis upon which we should judge whether they are worthy of office? So here's the one for president, as we think, you know, Ron Paul, Mitt Romney, Rick Santorum, whoever. This is what the president will say if elected, when elected, whoever it may be. I do solemnly swear that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States and will, to the best of my ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Which candidate for president would do the best job at that? Now, of course, in this crowd, and we'd probably get a near unanimous response in one direction. But still, think of others who might disagree with you. Think of others who claim to uphold the Constitution, maybe on some issues that they disagree with, but who are supporting a candidate for president who would not, in your view, faithfully preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Who on the campaign trail at this very moment may be advocating for policies that contradict the Constitution. Here's the one for Congress. It's very similar. I do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. It's always an interesting one. That I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. That is the standard. That's what we need to hold people accountable to. Are we doing a good job at that? I submit that we probably aren't. And I submit that a lot of the reason for that is that we, the electorate, are not consistently adhering to the Constitution ourselves. How can we expect a politician, we collectively, to abide by the Constitution if we ourselves are not doing the same? If they find that this person, you know, opposes Obamacare, but they like Medicare Part D, right, because maybe their mom's benefiting from it or whatever. And then when you compound that, when you abstract it out to the electorate at large, you find massive constitutional inconsistency, even from those who claim to be the most adherent advocates of the Constitution. You get this Tea Party upsurge and the 10th Amendment movement and the 9/12ers and everyone coming out, and you get the Tea Party class elected as freshmen to the House of Representatives, and they read the Constitution on the floor of Congress. They make this big dramatic thing about it, and we're going to read the Constitution word for word and each take turns. And then they take a vote that afternoon, and many of those same people vote against the Constitution in support of something. And I think that's because, in the aggregate, they see that the electorate inconsistently supports the Constitution. They don't feel accountable to us on the terms of the Constitution because they recognize, again, in the aggregate, that while we say we support the Constitution here, we loudly advocate for something here. I'll get into a few examples here. So, an old one, and then I'll get into some more recent ones. It was the Alien Sedition Acts. Does anyone not know what the Alien Sedition Acts? For your benefit, in case you don't want to raise your hand, and just so we're all on the same page, I'll briefly summarize it. There's a war with France. There's the Federalists. John Adams is president. They're agitating for war. And they pass a package of bills, then laws, once signed by Adams, which are known as the Alien and Sedition Acts, which gives the government, the federal government, wildly unconstitutional powers, specifically to criminalize criticizing the president or saying anything unkind about the government officers. They feared that the Federalists feared that the opposing party would say things and undermine the war effort, and they therefore criminalized, in contradiction to the First Amendment, the criminalized political speech. Now keep in mind that many of these same people were at the Constitutional Convention, were in the ratifying convention in their various states, were various patriots, we might say, in supporting the Constitution, and yet they voted for the Alien and Sedition Acts. This isn't something that applies to just us. The very people who signed the Constitution were supporting things at times that were against the Constitution. So the Alien and Sedition Acts were opposed by others, including Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who you may recall wrote the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions. If you haven't read them, of all the political literature that you can read, please read the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions. If you haven't read it in a while, read it again. You know, you probably know the Constitution chapter and verse, but if you don't know at least all the arguments made in the Kentucky and Virginia Resolutions, please read them. They're not long, but they're amazing in their potency of upholding the Constitution. Remember that Thomas Jefferson was the vice president to John Adams, and so in secret, he helped write some of these resolutions. I think he did Virginia and Madison did Kentucky. I might have that backwards. Opposite. Thank you. Either way, one of them wrote one of the state's resolutions, one of them wrote the other. And it was very forceful, and I didn't bring it with me. Please go read it when you get home. The substance of these resolutions basically says that the federal government has violated the Constitution, and that we as states, as parties to the compact of the Constitution, are one of the arbiters of what is constitutional. The Supreme Court of the United States, they argue, does not have the sole authority to determine questions of constitutionality. We as a state can, and therefore in this specific case, will resist. Fascinating. So they did, and it was really interesting. There's an excellent book by Tom Woods that talks about this and related issues called Simply Nullification by Tom Woods. Great book, I highly recommend it. And in there, he kind of describes some of the history of what happened with these resolutions. How many of the other states, dominated, of course, by members of the Federalist Party, objected to Jefferson and Madison, or rather Kentucky and Virginia, their legislatures, overwhelmingly passing these resolutions objecting to the federal government. What was interesting, if you look in Tom's book, as he kind of documents some of the history in the years ahead, some of the other issues, for example, when Jefferson became president, there was the big embargo that they had, and many of the states objected on constitutional grounds to this embargo. Rightly so. It was unconstitutional. And many of those same states, same legislators in the same legislatures of those states who had objected to Kentucky and Virginia's use of these arguments to uphold the Constitution against their own party when it benefited John Adams and members of their own party, now use the exact same arguments only years later in support of things that they liked when it was something that they opposed, in this case, Jefferson's embargo. So this isn't something that's endemic only to, you know, 21st century America, and we've strayed so far from the Constitution, and our founders were so wise. Yes, yes, they were wise, but they weren't perfect. And in many cases, like Jefferson, you know, the Louisiana Purchase, for example, we all kind of think it was a good thing. Even Jefferson, as he himself signed it and went through the process, recognized that there was no constitutional authority for it. So this isn't something that just falls on us, but it does fall on us. So for example, when Obama was running for president, he said many great things. He said a lot of really dumb things, but he said some really great things. Why? Because Bush was violating the Constitution to a significant degree. The Bush Doctrine, we like to call it. The torture, the secret renditions, the wiretapping, so many things being done as part of the broader war on terror that were unconstitutional. And constitutional scholar Obama in the Senate railed against these things. He's got some great speeches. I went and read some of them a few weeks back. And some of them are very articulate. They're very spot on. He was exactly right in his criticisms of what Bush was doing. And yet this man then becomes president. The man who had opposed the use of torture at Guantanamo, for example, who then as president assassinates an American citizen without any due process. No due process. Just the mere claim of that individual being a terrorist and supporting Al-Qaeda. And he kills him. The same president who, as we just said, signs the NDAA and claims the authority to lock you or I up on mere suspicion and throw away the key. Constitutional inconsistency. What's interesting is that same crowd that supported Obama and rightly used constitutional arguments to make their case against Bush, which I agreed with. I think many of them were spot on. Then opposed something like Citizens United. Many of you may not know what that is. It was a recent Supreme Court case which upheld the First Amendment and created what are now the super PACs that you hear a lot about, basically saying that political speech is not to be prohibited, like in the, I think it was McCain-Feingold was the bill that had done that previously. So now you have the progressive left that used the Constitution when it was something they disagreed with, the Bush Doctrine, now opposing the First Amendment of the Constitution because it was something they didn't like. But again, this doesn't just apply to the progressive left. You know, the Tea Party, as I said, overwhelmingly opposing Obamacare and yet supporting things that are unconstitutional. Medicare Part D as a big example. That was during the time when the Republicans had full control of the entire federal government and it overwhelmingly passed. People like Hatch still claim that it was this wonderful thing, even though it's a $16 trillion unfunded mandate. Our problem as those who claim to uphold the Constitution, and I'm not exempt from this, is making sure that the policies we support do not stem from constitutional convenience. That even when inconvenient, even when we agree with the ends, that if there are no constitutional means for achieving those ends, that we reject it, like that Madison quote at the beginning, that we recognize the violation of the principle, that we have the integrity and the knowledge to oppose it, even if it's something that we like or think that the federal government ought to do. One of the ones, for example, and as I said, I'm not exempt from this, and it's been for me an educational journey. When I was on Mike Lee's campaign, I had a good friend who introduced me to some history that I was previously unaware of. Prior to that time, I was a build the fence, kick all the illegals out, kind of anti-illegal immigration guy. And I'm sure there are some in this crowd who hold that same view, as I once did for a long time. And I was introduced to some history which contradicted my view. And I hadn't done it so well in years previously. I kind of, if I found anything conflicting, I didn't have the intellectual integrity yet to kind of face it head on and dissect it and say, well, am I still right and do I need to change my view? But by then I had kind of done that a few times enough that I just read through the whole history and was flabbergasted how wrong I was. And in my book, for those who picked it up, a lot of that's in the chapter on immigration. And I realized that here I'd been saying all this stuff about the Constitution and vocally and strongly opposing anyone who opposed the Constitution on something that I thought that they shouldn't be doing, and yet I had been supporting something which I came to realize, based on the history and based on the data, was not constitutional. And so even those of us who consider ourselves the strongest advocates of the Constitution, even those of us who, as I said, myself previously had been a member of the Constitution Party, as you are now, simply adopting that title and being a member of the party and claiming reverence for the Constitution does not exempt any of us, myself included, from, in some cases, perhaps supporting something that is not constitutional. I read the following in the Freeman magazine. I don't know how many of you are familiar with that. It's a great, great resource for information, and they post it all online. I wanted to read this brief paragraph because I think it exemplifies the message that I'm trying to convey. It says, both left and right claim that their particular concerns are sufficient to ignore the plain text of the Constitution in order to achieve some higher goal. But these dueling claims only serve to remind us that the whole point of having a Constitution is that it should provide consistent protection for individual rights, no matter who is in power or what the rationale is for weakening that protection. Having a Constitution is a way of trying to avoid these sort of arguments over what social goals are more important than protecting our rights. A constitution reminds us that no social goals are that important. No assertion of a threat requires that we sacrifice our rights. That is the only consistently constitutional position. So, as I said, this for me has been a journey, and it's one that I'm to this day not exempt from. And I submit that none of us is, or are. And really, I think that is what so much of this boils down to, because it's really easy to find, especially here in Utah, those who claim to support the Constitution, especially in a Latter-day Saint population that kind of natively has this strong religious regard for that document. Even if they might not have read it in a long time or really understand too much of it, they recognize, as I myself am a Latter-day Saint, that is an inspired document. And I know many people who feel that it was the hand of Providence, including many of the founders, of course, who are not members of that church that's so predominant here in Utah. The reason I mention that, though, is because I think we have an opportunity, and I think we have very fertile ground here in Utah. And that is why so much of my political effort over the past few years has turned from federal issues to state issues, because I think we need to clean house. I think we need to look inward a bit more. And I think that we have a great opportunity to do so, because where those inconsistencies exist, where we find someone who claims to support the Constitution and yet maybe they're supporting a certain program or a war or what have you that is not constitutional, I think it's very easy, and you probably agree with me in your own experience, that it's very easy to reason with that person because you have a common base to go on. And you can say, well, you agree with the Constitution. Let's go back and read, you know, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2 about habeas corpus. Therefore, now what do you think about the NDAA? Now do you think it's wrong to support a candidate for Congress or an incumbent politician who signed that and violated that explicit provision of the Constitution? That's only one example. There are many on a variety of whether domestic or foreign policies where the popular position, the one that maybe is more fear-based or that the media is trumping up or the pundits are overwhelmingly favoring, where it's easy to support something and not give it a lot of thought. And I speak from personal experience on that. I've recognized that a lot in my life, that once I kind of learned the contradicting and the more substantive policy and realized how wrong I realized that it was superficial for me before. I agreed to it because maybe everyone else I kind of generally agreed with all held the same view, but I hadn't studied that myself. I think that's a temptation that we face, and that we need to make sure if we claim to be upholding the Constitution, that we're kind of doing that self-analysis on every issue and making sure that what we're supporting does not violate the Constitution. In closing, I want to read that Madison quote again, now having kind of reviewed and shared some of those remarks. Think again about the violation of that principle and how we can make that change today. He says that the free men of America did not wait until usurped power had strengthened itself by exercise and entangled the question in precedence. They saw all the consequences in the principle, and they avoided the consequences by denying the principle. We revere this lesson too much soon to forget it. My invitation to you, to myself, is to make sure not only that we ourselves are being constitutionally consistent and not just constitutionally convenient, but that as we work to kind of spread the gospel of liberty and preach the Constitution to those around us, as we work to hold politicians accountable, and as we judge candidates for office who are seeking that political power, that we're applying the same standard to them. And that before we apply that standard to them, we make sure that we ourselves are adhering to that standard, right? Because if they see in us that inconsistency, they're going to find subconsciously that wiggle room. And they're going to know that you can't really hold their feet to the fire because, well, look at you, you support this, and so why should I listen to you? It's a challenge we all face. It's a challenge I face on an ongoing basis. So my standing invitation is to make Madison's words applicable in our day. He speaks in the past tense, the freemen of America did not wait until usurped power, right? We need freemen of America today who recognize, as Frederick Bastiat once said, many of you have read him, the consequences, the unintended consequences of what we're doing, how easy it is to see the violation of something that everyone recognizes, how uneasy, how difficult it is to see something that's popular and yet unconstitutional. And I leave that invitation with you and express my hope. I think after the caucus on a week ago Thursday, that third parties of all kind, or independents in general, Constitution Party included, stand a great chance at increasing their numbers and spreading their message. There are right now a lot of disaffected, Constitution, freedom-loving Republicans and members of other party who are fed up with the way things are going, who are leaving the party en masse, who are looking for something else. And so I don't say this necessarily as an endorsement of one party over the other, but just as I think we stand at a really interesting time right now. I think the cause of liberty is set to gain some significant ground, especially with the younger generation. I see it a lot with those, you know, I have three younger brothers, and they know what the Federal Reserve is, and they've, you know, read all this material, and they're not going out partying, they're reading this thick tome on history. And, you know, I think in the rising generation we have a lot of hope, and I hope you have that same hope. And I think that we need to make sure that as that rising generation is coming up and we're seeking to teach them and lead them in the way of supporting the Constitution, that we're making sure that we are teaching the right things, that we are being constitutionally consistent. And I leave with you my hope for the future. I think we stand a good chance at moving this cause forward, and thank you for your efforts.